Hello, I'm Philip Boucher-Hayes, and you're very welcome to this week's Playback podcast. Now, this might come as something of a shock to you, but apparently everyone has got Donald Trump wrong, and he's actually lovely.
Some biographers have described him as narcissistic, cruel, short-tempered, easily distracted. Would you have seen any of those traits?
Honestly, no.
Madeleine Westerhout was Donald Trump's executive assistant. She's written what on Monday must have felt like an impeccably well-timed book, not so much today, about what a great guy Trump is. She battled bravely through Sarah McInerney's open scepticism.
And would he ever react aggressively or very negatively to any of those sort of comments? Like if you were to suggest to him, for example, that that might not be a good tweet or that might not be a good idea, would he ever react like that?
Oh, absolutely not. No, I never really saw him get angry or frustrated too often. And when he did, it was very justified. But I think he respects people that challenge him when they have a reason. And he respects. Yes, I do. Absolutely. I think he gets frustrated when people tell him no or disagree with him just to disagree with him. But I saw it every single day. He welcomes differences of opinions and people that challenge his thinking and his decision making. But, like I said, at the end of the day, he's the one to make the final decision. I understand that everyone has their opinion of the president, but my interaction and my experience with him was incredibly positive, and I wanted to share that with the American people. And I never sought out to change everybody's minds, but just maybe have people pause and stop and think about some of the things they've heard about him, because the president that I got to know was very, very kind and generous and loves this country so much and is just absolutely enamored by the Oval Office and by the office of the presidency.
Hmm.
You may not have heard Sarah McInerney's response there. Let me play it for you again.
Hmm.
And to make things worse, Fake News McInerney asked her about the circumstances of her departure from the White House. One night, Madeleine had innocently boasted to journalists that she had a better relationship with Trump than his children did, and that the president didn't like being photographed with his younger daughter Tiffany because she was overweight. She was fired, and Trump went on to helpfully remind Madeleine in a tweet that she had signed a non-disclosure agreement.
I made a mistake and I had a major lapse of judgment that night at dinner with some reporters. And I would rather not get into the specifics of what I said or I didn't say. I've taken responsibility for everything that happened that night. The president has forgiven me. And, I think some things were taken out of context there as well.
Okay, but that comment about not wanting to be photographed with his daughter who's overweight, does that speak to you of a person who respects women?
Well, like I said, I made a mistake that evening, and some of the things that I said or I didn't say, they're not true. And so I know the president has a great relationship with his daughters, and he truly loves them. And I don't think that's not the case.
Okay. Just finally then, President Trump, he has endorsed your book. He describes you as a very smart and already wise young woman. So will he get your vote tomorrow? I'm not sure if you voted for him in 2016.
He absolutely will. I voted early this year, so I have already cast my vote for President Trump in 2020, and I'm very proud to do so.
And that should be good enough for all of us. But it wasn't. Elsewhere on Radio 1, rampant Irish pro-Biden bias was on display.
In that paper's opinion pages, Fintan O'Toole writes of the psychological effect that President Trump and the 2020 campaign has had on Americans. He cites a survey from the American Psychological Association released in October, which found that two-thirds of Americans reported the election as a significant source of stress in their life. He also writes that President Trump has become a psychological burden, adding, "He has almost literally got on the nerves of the majority of Americans. He squats on their brains like a giant orange toad, belching out indignation."
Sinead Egan doing it says in the papers. Were commentators perhaps losing the run of their sympathies? Drive Time thought that it would be a good idea to redress Ireland's instinctive Democratic Party bias by having former Trump chief strategist Steve Bannon on to assess the election. That may have been their intention, but what Cormac O'Hara got was an illustration of how confusion is their strategy.
Once again, the media always trying to spin it. Okay, in 16, the ballots weren't even close to being counted. when he was declared the winner by the
Is this really Spain? This is just a valid question.
Am I the one spinning here?
You've called the virus the CCP virus, the China virus, and you say that it's democratic mass hysteria. Let me ask a question. You're saying it's democratic mass hysteria that has caused the early voting. I wonder, is it 230,000 deaths in the US and Trump's handling of the virus that's causing hysteria?
Hang on for a second. Did you just say, do you not think this came from the Chinese Communist Party, from the lab in Wuhan?
You think it's a Chinese invention, is that right?
It's either, we know for a fact, if you look at the scientists, we know for a fact it either came from a gain-of-function experiment in the Wuhan lab, or it came as part of a bioweapons program.
Steve Bannon. Now, that stuff about the lab in Wuhan is proven to be untrue, but it wasn't to be long before those seeds of confusion is our brand blossomed. Incidentally, that's probably going to be the last time you'll be hearing Steve Bannon on RT Radio. On Thursday night, the mask that he probably wasn't wearing slipped when he called for the head of the FBI and also the White House coronavirus advisor, Dr. Anthony Fauci, to be beheaded as a warning to all public servants. If you were sensible and you waited until morning for the election result, well then this next bit is not for you. If you watched Wolf Blitzer and John King stand in front of television screens repeating themselves all night, well then this is a top tip especially for you. Radio 1 picked up NPR, National Public Radio's coverage from the States, and ran with it all night into Wednesday morning. It was absolutely the best way to track the unfolding high-wire drama.
Now let's go to NPR's Tamara Keith, who is covering the Trump campaign.
So earlier in this hour, I told you that the TVs are tuned to Fox News in the election night party at the White House.
As each state went blue, we got an idea of the furious reaction in the West Wing.
Well, Fox News called Arizona for Joe Biden. This earned a very upset response from someone inside the Trump campaign war room.
NPR even managed to put you in the Biden motorcade on the way to deliver his middle-of-the-night pep speech to supporters.
He is making his way from his house to the Chase Center in Wilmington, where Biden had hoped to give a victory speech tonight. He is making his way there in a very large, very fast-moving motorcade. This will, of course, not be a victory speech. This is a very close race right now. You mentioned several states that just went President Trump's way. But I will tell you, Democrats feel more confident than they did just a couple of hours ago. They feel good about Arizona. And Democrats I'm talking to in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania feel very confident that when all the votes are counted, he will be ahead.
Your patience is commendable. We knew this was going to go long, but who knew we're going to go into maybe tomorrow morning, maybe even longer. But look, we feel good about where we are. We really do. I'm here to tell you tonight, we believe we're on track to win this election.
Socially distanced supporters honking their approval. Contrast that now with the picture painted by radio reporters as President Trump gave his rebuttal.
There is no social distance in this room, and I don't see a single mask on that video screen at the time.
Several Trump family members walking on stage. We see his children.
Gentlemen. President of the United States, Donald J. Trump.
And this was where the radio coverage was markedly different to TV. Some of the TV news networks limply warned in advance of Trump speaking that he would probably falsely try and claim that he had won and that the Democrats were trying to steal the election. But they went ahead and they broadcast the speech live anyway. Whereas listeners on Radio 1 would have heard the NPR presenter break in and speak over the president to fact-check him live when he started to make up his own facts.
So Florida was a tremendous victory, 377,000. Texas, as we said,
All right, we want to just do some fact-checking right now. The president is saying that he is winning certain states. We are not, I repeat, we are not at 270 electoral votes. The Associated Press has not called several of the states that President Trump is claiming pending victory in, states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin. Again, I repeat, we are not at 270 electoral votes. The president cannot declare victory at this moment.
With almost nothing left.
Less Gettysburg address than gibberish address, but as Trump ramped up his claims and sowed deliberate seeds of confusion in the public mind, NPR's Ailsa Chang was once again smothering the flames with a blanket of facts.
This is a fraud on the American public. This is an embarrassment to our country. We were getting ready to win this election. Frankly, we did win this election. We did win this election. So our goal now is to ensure the integrity.
We have just heard several misstatements from President Trump about where the vote counts have gone. I want to bring in NPR's Ron Elving right now. Ron, let's just do a reset here. We heard President Trump basically declaring victories, talking about battleground states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, as heading his way in terms of victory. Can you just reset all of this for us? Remind this country that voting has stopped and that vote counting will not stop, despite what he has said tonight.
So, Larry Donnelly, how are you then after hearing your president claim the election?
I'm still in shock. I listened to what he said, and it was a series of unbelievable non sequiturs that didn't follow whatsoever.
Political columnist Larry was in the Morning Ireland studio, struggling to get his head around the enormity of Trump's "I've won, but Biden's committed fraud" claim.
An absolute nightmare of epic proportions for the United States.
Nevertheless, just for fear people who are joining us get the impression that the voting, that the counting has stopped.
No,
the counting hasn't stopped.
I mean, that was just absolute rubbish that he could say that, and that anyone in that room who, with a seed of intelligence, who listens to that rubbish, claps in response to it, is just extraordinary. It's mind-boggling.
Claire Byrne had the clever idea of turning to a friend of Donald Trump's, Ian Paisley Jr., for translation of that rubbish.
I don't know. I mean, I've met the man several times and know him and know his family. I please do not try and ask me to interpret what he means by some of the stuff that he says, Claire, because I don't think anyone actually can. I mean, it is a fascinating race to watch and fascinating character to watch.
Doesn't surprise you then that he would say something that we can't interpret?
Are you surprised by anything Donald Trump says now?
When confusion is the strategy and the result, it is far easier to sell your own version of events to supporters. Create, as Steve Bannon said to Cormac O'Hara on Drive Time just 17 hours earlier, create your own narrative, one that supporters can willingly then buy into. Supporters like Irish woman Alice Butler Short, founder of Virginia Women for Trump, who also talked to Claire.
I vote Donald Trump because he came at a time when this country needed a warrior. This country needed somebody who would stand up and stand firm and fight for America. This man, he strengthened our military. He gave us the greatest economy we'd had for God knows how long. We had hardly any unemployment. Everything was going beautifully until COVID struck. And even with the repercussions of COVID, we are still, this past month, our GDP went up 33.1%. So this is a man who, while he is being eviscerated every single day, has gone out there engaging with the people, telling people what he is doing, telling the people what he will do in the next 4 years.
How did you feel a couple of hours ago when he declared victory, Alice, when clearly the votes haven't been counted, far from it?
Well, I thought that's okay. We just have to remain calm. I could understand his anger when he said people have to stop voting. What he meant was the left have a history of voter fraud. What he meant was that
really
he did not. Yes, really, really go back to John F. Kennedy and figure out why he was elected.
There is no history of voter fraud in the US on either side. GDP did rise 33% in the last quarter, but had dropped nearly 40% in the preceding two quarters. Unemployment did drop by 1% under Trump, but by 2% under Obama, and so on and on. And when Today with Claire Byrne put a Democrat on with Alice Butler short, confusion.
We have, you know, a president who says that we need to stop the counting of the votes that have been cast validly on November 3rd and states that he's going to go to the Supreme Court to stop the voting or to stop the counting. And there's no precedent.
That kind of slavish devotion is dangerous in the opinion of a caller to Liveline.
Obviously, a lot of people who follow him like a cult leader. And could he fuel violence on the streets? Yeah, I guess he could, if he's going to encourage people to take matters into their arms.
Now, you've heard these alarming blood-in-the-streets predictions before, but this Liveline caller was none other than the former director of the CIA, John Brennan, who had first met Trump in Trump Towers in 2016 when the then-president-elect had rejected Brennan's assessment that Russia had meddled in that election on his behalf.
This is a very, very unfortunate chapter of U.S. history, but it shows just how deeply divided our country is. And I think the fact that the election is this close is more of the United States political environment right now than it is of Donald Trump, because Donald Trump has tapped into a sentiment of the American electorate that really doesn't care if their leader is dishonest, has no integrity. And, pursues an agenda that I think is antithetical to what the United States has stood for the last 200-some-odd years.
But that looks like it's 49, if not 51% of the American voters.
Well, exactly right. And I think it's it's disappointing to me that Americans are looking inward now. And it's very much of a selfish, quite frankly, approach to life. Donald Trump's mantra of America first, America first, really an abdication of the United States' global leadership role that we have played, since World War II. And that's why I was really hoping that Joe Biden, and still hope that Joe Biden, is going to become president, because he believes in the partnerships and the alliances and the friends that we have developed overseas. He believes that the United States should be involved in the Paris Climate Accord and other multi-level initiatives to try to address some of the world's, most significant challenges. And so if Joe Biden is elected, I think he's going to see a return of the United States that most Irish women and men have known throughout the course of their lives. But as I said, unfortunately, Donald Trump reflects the attitudes and the views of a very large segment of the United States population. Okay.
Just before midnight on Thursday, Donald Trump made a statement on which he refused to take questions from reporters.
The counting in Pennsylvania and other key states are all part of a corrupt Democrat machine that you've written about. And for a long time, you've been writing about the corrupt Democrat machine.
Washington correspondent Brian O'Donovan put it in context on Morning Ireland the next morning.
And he went on this rant that was almost like a pick your conspiracy theory off the internet. He spoke about how there was shenanigans and how some counting centres had put up paper to block the view of the election observers. He said some of his staff had to use binoculars to see the papers. He spoke about a burst water pipe that delayed counting. And he made repeated reference to Philadelphia being a centre for corruption. Overnight, police in Philadelphia have investigated an alleged plot to attack the Pennsylvania Convention Center where ballots are being counted. That's the danger here when you have Donald Trump standing at the podium in the White House saying they are trying to rob an election from me. And a few hours later, police investigate a plot to attack a counting center. It's a worrying time.
There have been a number of disturbing irregularities across the nation. Our campaign has been denied access to observe any counting in Detroit. Detroit is another place, and I wouldn't say has the best reputation for election integrity.
Zoe Clark from Michigan Public Radio reported to Claire Byrne on the consequences in Detroit of what Donald Trump was stoking.
Zoe, was that something that was happening generally in Michigan?
No, absolutely not. This will really seem to be an isolated incident, and we're already having reports that really it was actually the Republican Party, some Trump supporters who had sort of staged this rally. You heard folks yelling, "Stop the count," which folks in Detroit did not do. I should also note there were hundreds of poll watchers who were in that building in Detroit alone. Michigan Radio had reporters at counting stations both in Detroit and Grand Rapids. And as of now, I can definitively say we have seen nothing that amounts to any kind of voter fraud. Now, again, you know, I can't definitively say that there may not be word or other lawsuits like that, but we had folks at the polls and did not see any of what some of these challenges and things that you're seeing on Twitter and social media say.
In the run-up to this election, Zoe, it was said by commentators both here and there that the worst result here would be a narrow win for Joe Biden because of the unrest that would happen as a result. Do you share those concerns?
Look, I mean, I think the fact is, you know, and if you're playing a drinking game in Ireland right now, every time an American says we're a divided country, well, then, you know, drink up. But it does still appear we are a divided country.
Whatever about drinking games, there is a downside to all of this staying up and watching election coverage that nobody is talking about. Shayburn trying to introduce Des Cahill on yesterday's Rise in Time is a perfect example.
Hi, Des. I'm great. How are you? I had a hard weekend, Des. What are you doing, Des, at the moment?
There's people waking up now who had a glass of wine last night. Go, oh, I shouldn't have.
Did you eat all your vegetables at the weekend, Des? Because I did. Spent the weekend on the toilet. Anyway.
Shay has stayed up since Tuesday night watching CNN and has gone to work each morning for a 5:30 start. By 7 a.m. on Friday, it was obvious how badly he needed his sleep.
Your jumper's lovely, Death.
Let me pick a song.
Always look at the bright side of life, Sweet Caroline.
I wonder why.
These will all cheer people up.
Oasis are lovely, lads. Yeah, go on.
Yeah, I'd choose Wonderwall, but maybe if it, go Wonderwall.
Are you doubting yourself?
Sweet Caroline, I sing myself.
Oh, jeez, I'll turn off the mic.
Yeah. I'll sing it down if you like.
Where have you been gone? Lovely lads, the Gallagher brothers.
Thank you, Des.
All right,
see you at the weekend. You're on the weekend. You're on Saturday.
I'd love to know what you're on.
Insomnia.
We may need to pace ourselves a bit better here. In Bush v. Gore in 2000, when they went to the courts, W wasn't finally declared president until December the 12th. One final footnote to the election before we move on. The former children's minister, Catherine Zappone, has moved back to the US where she was campaigning for Donald Trump.
It is amazing to be part of this campaign here in the United States of America, Miriam. And of course, you know, this weekend is so critical in terms of as we move into the final stretch, and we're all absolutely on the phones. Many people are actually canvassing door to door.
Just checking to see if you're awake. Of course she's campaigning for Biden. She had a long chat with Miriam O'Callaghan about getting back into politics, life after losing the love of her life, Anne Louise, and the books that she is writing. But this is the bit of that interview that sticks out. How to ask the cheeky personal question and how to deflect it with panache.
Because actually you sound so energetic. It's as though you've been reborn, because after the death of Anne Louise, you were obviously
yes.
quite rightly very
yes.
sad, very low.
Yes.
Has New York given you a new lease of life, obviously writing these two books? Have
yes.
you found more love?
Miriam. Love of?
A special other.
Oh, well, may I say three things answering that question, Miriam?
You may.
Okay. First of all, you certainly are aware of how much I adore Anne Louise.
Yeah.
That's the first thing. Secondly, I have always tried to live my life in an open manner. And thirdly, you're just going to have to read the book that I'm writing.
Okay, first interview when that's published, okay, Catherine?
Okay.
Catherine Zappone. There was another interview on Sunday with Miriam that caught you kind of by surprise, but for a very different reason. Miriam went to Drumcondra, where Archbishop Diarmaid Martin is packing his bags.
I'm beginning the process of moving. I have made a very, very strong resolution never to collect so much rubbish and books and objects and vases that I'll never do it again, because although I effectively live in two rooms here, I'll be moving into a smaller presbytery. It'll have five rooms, but those five rooms will probably fit into one of the rooms in this house. They're all very, very big.
After a while, their conversation turned to the ongoing emotional impact of the mother and baby homes on the lives of those that they still cast a shadow across. A story that Diarmaid Martin told about trying to locate someone's birth mother showed his appreciation of the legacy of the homes.
You know, they're not just survivors in some cases. They're still being victimised, you know. There must be ways. I understand the legal difficulties that are there. They've been there for years, but we have to find a way of overcoming that so that people can find not just their birth mother, but it's part of themselves. And it's the progress is far too slow. I had another occasion when, as a young man, this boy, he came out of an industrial school, said to me, "Would you be able to find my mother?" You know? Mm-hmm. And we did find the mother. And we went to the mother and baby home. And I remember the nun said, that woman had no interest in her child. But we kept going and going and going. And then one day we arrived in to the snug of a pub in a rural town and asked to see this woman. And in she came. She was elderly. She was terrified. And she was cleaning the place. And she had a blackberry in her hand, which she kept fingering. And we said to her, "Do you ever remember a little boy?" And her face lit up. And you could see on her face, he's alive. Somebody knows him. Somebody's looking after him. And, you know, it sticks in my mind, that woman. Now, it didn't work out. You know, that neither he nor her really had the ability to bond. But it wasn't that she wasn't interested in her baby. That baby was there all the time in her mind, you know.
Archbishop Diarmaid Martin. But political attention was no longer really focused on mother and baby homes this week. The Dáil was consumed by a scandal that never really threatened the government's resolve to circle the wagons and keep itself in government. Leo Varadkar was in trouble because he had leaked a copy of an IMO contract to a rival doctors' union. When a senior politician is in trouble is an exercise that broadcasters have to do, as many of the politician's colleagues as possible get put through pretty much the same interview. Sometimes it reveals if the knives are out and if the politician is in trouble. Sometimes it's tedious because everyone sticks to the speaking notes supplied by Party HQ. And this week, it was tedious as we heard the same interview over and over.
The Taoiseach, as party leader, has said that he acknowledges that the way that information was shared was not best practice.
Pascal Donoghue was first. He sounded not unlike a college lecturer stuck in a tutorial with a room full of very dim undergraduates. The next day he was followed by Helen McEntee in the role of a woman speaking through teeth so gritted she sounded like her jaws were wired together.
Taoiseach himself has said the manner in which this was delivered could have been done better. It was not best practice. However,
but 2 hours later, we had Simon Harris reprising the role of somebody speaking through gritted teeth with an added touch of innocent bystander caught up in events that he cannot comprehend.
He's acknowledged that it wasn't best practice the way in which it went about.
He was undermining you, because if anyone was going to share that agreement with the NAGP, it was you.
No, I don't believe he was undermining me, and I don't think it's about me either.
And just in case you were thinking about changing the channel, Barry Lenehan reported that resistance to Fine Gael's message of support for its leader was futile.
Talking to Fine Gael over the last 24 hours or so, they're rallying around their leader, of course, senior ministers Pascal Donoghue and Helen McEntee out batting for Leo Varadkar on the national airwaves. As we speak, a squadron of Fine Gael TDs and senators are currently on local radio defending Leo Varadkar.
And really, we should have known with a single bound our hero was free, when one of Fianna Fáil's former agriculture ministers, forced out of office in part at Fine Gael's insistence, said, no, this was not a hanging offence.
It wasn't necessarily best practice. It might even have been inappropriate.
but it was with the best intentions of seeking to ensure that GPs would agree the contract or the new or updated contract which had been agreed between the IMO and the Department of Health.
And while it might all have been over before it ever really began, the Tánaiste still had to go through the script in the Dáil.
I do accept that the provision of the agreement by an informal communicational channel to the President of the NAGP in the way that I did
altogether now
was not good practice.
What we hadn't been able to appreciate until he spoke in the Dáil was that Leo Varadkar felt that he was partly the victim here of someone telling others that they were closer friends than they were.
Ciarán Chorla, sometimes people like to exaggerate the nature of their relationships, to inflate their own influence, or to claim to speak for a person that they don't, to claim to have greater access than they really have. Friends and acquaintances and supporters may claim to be closer to you than they really are. And this is clearly a big part of this story. And Ciarán Chorla, if we're honest, most of us in this house are familiar with that phenomenon too.
This was, in the words of Fionnán Sheehan on Drive Time, all about the unfriending of Matthew O'Toole. Dr. Varadkar was, in his assessment, notably not taking any of his medicine.
All we really got from Leo Varadkar there was a history of GP's contracts in Ireland. He said at the start that he would be apologising for my errors of judgment, but he doesn't actually do that. He says sorry that there's now a controversy. So when he says he regrets it and he's sorry for the controversy and the annoyance that this has caused.
Oliver Callan also noted that it was a bit of a non-apology apology.
Dr. Matthew, or whatever his name, was not my friend. He wasn't as slavishly loyal as I like my hangers-on to be, and I'm not sure the Leo t-shirt looked all that good on him. He's not my friend. We just hang out, chat, message each other, go out. I send him confidential things in the post. He literally wears clothes with my name on them and joins me in group hugs for social media snaps on nights out. But that's all. True friendship is when someone sticks by you no matter how badly you treat them because you're a totes amazeballs leader who knows how to fill out a suit. Sending your man the document was an error. I should have sent him a Mission Impossible file that would self-destruct in 5 seconds. Hashtag movie line reference. It was a mistake, but one I hold my hands up to now that I've been caught and ask people to ignore and or promptly forget. So today I say sorry. Sometimes I make mistakes, like leaking things that make me look good or letting 10,000 people go homeless. But unfortunately, you can't print out houses and get your PA to send them to your friends. If we could, we'd probably post them to the vulture landlords. Lol fictions. Ciarán Chorla, we are where we are. We all partied. Let's put our shoulder to the wheel now, etc, etc. And let's focus on how totes hilarious it is to be called Taoiseach every 2 seconds by Mirage Martin. Yes.
And this is where you might have been excused for thinking that the whole thing should have been done and dusted. Except it wasn't. Fianna Fáil had yet to tear itself to pieces. This happened in a meeting about Leo's leaks that was itself leaked almost as it happened.
Afterwards, like some of the TDs and senators and MEPs I was talking to described the whole affair as a car crash, brutal, a full frontal attack with a Gatling gun, the worst parliamentary party meeting I've ever attended. But it also has to be said that many members who were there were highly critical of, particularly Deputy McSharry, with one saying his performance was disgraceful, over the top and totally unnecessary, and another one saying that it was a rant that Donald Trump would have been proud of.
Paul Cunningham told Morning Ireland listeners that frequent dissenting voice in the parliamentary party, Mark McSharry, had a
belt at the Taoiseach Micheál Martin, where he said he was beyond disgust and depression at how the Leo Varadkar leaked document issue had been handled. And he said there was a palpable anger among the membership across the country at Mr. Varadkar's actions, but he accused the Taoiseach of acting, as he called it, the chief flag flyer for Leo, who had told what he said was a fairy tale a six-year-old could see through. He also criticised Micheál Martin for attacking Sinn Féin rather than attacking Leo Varadkar, and said that Mr. Martin had dragged the party to 11% in the opinion polls and he needed to accept the reality that he was part of the problem. Micheál Martin did come back at that, and he said he'd always been crystal clear that the Tánaiste's actions were wrong, that Fianna Fáil was not accountable for the actions of the last government and shouldn't get dragged into that type of issue. And he personally takes a long-term view on such issues as the difficulties being faced by Mr. Varadkar. But things really blew up when he said that he wanted to take exception to the personalised nature of the critique that Deputy McSharry had been directing at him. But Mark McSharry interjected, saying there's nothing personal about this. You're the leader of the party, and if you can't take it, you shouldn't be leading the party.
Mark McSharry later said that some of the reporting of the meeting was incomplete and some of it inaccurate. If unreliable narrators is one of the themes of the last week's radio, RT Radio 1 is itself guilty of not getting its own stories straight. On Sunday, we had two separate programmes, both purporting to set an important historical record straight, but both adopting opposing positions.
Early on, Kevin Barry has Sunday been immortalised in ballads on clubhouses, a flat complex, and on memorials, including one in Glasnevin Cemetery, where he was given a state funeral.
On the This Week programme, Elaine Keogh presented a report under the headline, Kevin Barry, What Really Happened?
100 years ago today, Kevin Barry was executed in Mountjoy Prison. The young medical student and IRA volunteer was sentenced to hang for his role in an ambush.
Later that evening on The History Show, Miles Dungan presented a programme that purported to examine the mythologies surrounding the fallen rebel, Kevin Barry. In the two programmes, Barry was variously described as either the victim or the villain of the piece. Come on, lads, which is it? Elaine Keogh's report heard that the narrative constructed around Barry was IRA propaganda, which endures to this day.
Freelance propaganda, if you like, particularly in the Freeman's Journal or in papers like the Irish Catholic, who portrayed Barry entirely as a victim in this struggle, scarcely mentioning the fact that he'd been involved in an attack which led to the deaths of three young British soldiers. The British, by contrast, I don't think were particularly adept at this. I mean, after all, one of the soldiers that Barry killed was a boy of 15. And yet the names of these soldiers scarcely appeared in the British newspapers. I seem to remember seeing in the Daily Mirror, I think it was, or perhaps the Daily Herald, a photograph of Kevin Barry with the headline, The Boy Who Is to Die. And yet there were no photographs of the soldiers, no stories about their weeping mothers and so on. So while the name of Kevin Barry is remembered today in Ireland, the names of the three soldiers that he was involved in killing are completely forgotten.
Dr. Martin Doherty, University of Westminster. The programme then heard from Chris Fitzpatrick, a medical professor in Kevin Barry's alma mater, UCD, who was concerned that this centenary would once again make a hero of Barry.
We are at the present time teaching medical students to be compassionate, teaching them to care. And I think that it is inappropriate for us to hold up a medical student who thought very differently for a variety of circumstances as a role model in terms of standing up for what was right. That's not the way to do it. You know, I think if you're looking for role models, Kevin Barry is not a role model, certainly that I would hold up.
This week at 1 o'clock on Sunday. Then, listeners tuning into The History Show just 4 short hours later will have been struck by RTE's inability to get the story straight, as that programme heard first from Barry's grandniece, Siafra O'Donovan, arguing in favour of her granduncle's commemoration.
He did take a life, that is true, but he also gave his own life. He knew what he was heading into. He didn't choose to escape. He didn't choose and push for people to get him a reprieve. He chose not to give the names of his comrades. It's about the history of our country. It's about our heritage. I think that there's a slight amnesia in this country. That was a war fought by an army who were mandated by a democratic government, who were voted democratically in. This is the foundation of our state. And if you choose and decide to not commemorate Kevin Barry, not commemorate, you know, Michael Collins, not commemorate anybody. So if you choose not to, you're really choosing to just turn a blind eye to those people who actually did put their lives on the line to make it possible for us to have a Republic of Ireland.
for the cause he proudly cherished. This at
And then later in the history show, Schieffer's cousin, Kevin Barry's grandnephew, the historian Eunan O'Halpin, argued that there were many medical students like Barry who conscientiously joined the ranks of the IRA, knowing exactly what that meant.
Well, look, I'm just thinking I'm about half a mile from where, in April 1920, a medical student named Hugo McNeil, who had been in St. Mary's with Kevin for a year and that was then in UCD, he and another member of the squad stepped forward and shot a detective as the detective left his house on Pleasant Street off Camden Street. Medical students in 1920, whatever they might have done once they qualified, saw themselves first and foremost, those who joined the IRA, as people fighting a legitimate war for their cause and for the freedom of their country. They certainly, if they joined the IRA, they did so in the knowledge that they had to be willing to kill and to be killed. And that the medical students, as far as I can see, are disproportionately represented as compared with other UCD students in the Dublin IRA. And you see that on Bloody Sunday. A man I knew very well, the brilliant Colonel Dan Bryan, who became head of military intelligence, was an outstanding intelligence officer. But he was, as were inverted commas, a medical student, but out on Bloody Sunday. He wasn't shooting anybody, he was doing surveillance on the streets. There's loads of people who qualify as doctors and dentists because they're all first meds and vets who were involved actually not only in being on the streets and Bloody Sunday, but in killing people. And that's what you do in war, and their view was we're at war and this is what we do.
The coincidence of two different programmes failing to agree on something that happened 100 years ago fits neatly with the week that was. A week when two men tried to take control of a crucial narrative by either being first out of the traps or claiming their own facts. We would do well to remember that America is not the only country in the world where one man's seductive storyline is another's outright lie. Have a good weekend.
We feel good about where we are. We really do. I'm here to tell you tonight, we believe we're on track to win this election.
A very sad group of people is trying to disenfranchise that group of people, and we won't stand for it.
But it may take a little longer, as I've said all along. It's not my place or Donald Trump's place to declare who's won this election. That's the decision of the American people. But I'm optimistic about this outcome.
They knew they couldn't win. So they said, let's go to court. And did I predict this, Newt? Did I say this? I've been saying this from the day I heard they were going to send out tens of millions of ballots.
Keep the faith, guys. We're going to win this. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Your patience is great.
This is a fraud on the American public. This is an embarrassment to our country. We were getting ready to win this election. Frankly, we did win this election. We did win this election.